Welcome to the Mentors Project, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Today's guest is Stacia Raymond, author of Grace Notes, a novel based on the life of Henry Mancini, the four-time Academy Award-winning composer of Moon River and the theme to The Pink Panther. But you may not know, he also contributed music to the cult films like The Creature from the Black Lagoon. And even fewer folks will likely know that while in the army, he was part of the liberation of a concentration camp in Austria. Welcome, Stacia.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have you here. We're going to start today with one of our early questions, which is always, why does Mancini matter to us today?
Wow, well, I think music isn't going anywhere, right? I think for anyone who is a music lover, it's important to sort of realize, you know, what the antecedents are to songs, to styles, even to rhythms. And so that they're not just whether you're a music creator or just a music appreciator, you know sort of the basis for these things and the history of these things. And Mancini was somebody who wrote in so many different styles that anyone, there's something for everyone in his body of work.
Well, how beautiful. I think that's true. So what were the burning issues and questions that he had to deal with in his day?
Well, I would say it was equality and civil rights. I mean, Mancini was someone who despised prejudice and racism. And, you know, as an Italian, he'd been exposed to some of this mostly through his parents' experiences, who were the immigrants. But even from a young age, he could never understand why his town, West Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, was designed in a way that segregated people along ethnic lines. It was a town bought by Laughlin Steele, who employed his father and about 90% of the town. And they bought all this land, and they created plans, as they called them, but they were sections. And so you'd have your Polish section and your Italian section and your Irish section and so on and so forth. And so the only time as a youngster that he really had any crossover other than at school was through music, because he started to play professionally or semi-professionally at bar mitzvahs and baptisms and different events like that. And so he was exposed to other cultures and their music in that sense. But when he started to become successful, he was a great supporter of black musicians in particular as they were coming up. And, you know, he was not a person who was easily moved to anger. But one of the times that that happened was he got a call about, you know, his friend Quincy Jones from Universal Executive saying, well, we're thinking about hiring this guy Quincy. What do you think? And he said, what do you mean, what do I think? He did the pawnbroker, you know, he studied with some of the best around the world. What's the hesitation? And he kind of picked up on these racial undertones to the conversation and just said, you know, you'd be crazy not to hire him. And sort of slammed down the phone. So the other thing that happened as far as this being something that fueled him in life was when the family was getting ready to sell their home in Northridge, where they'd raised the kids for quite a while, the three children, and move on up to Beverly Hills, they were shocked when they found out that their neighbors would be very upset if they had sold their home to a black family. And Henry's wife, Ginny, was half Mexican, but a lot of people didn't know that. She's now what we'd call white passing because she was blonde most of the time, but they were just both appalled that their children had grown up around people who still held those attitudes. So it was something that really angered him and something that he fought hard against.
So in many ways, that gives us a good explanation of how his childhood influenced his later work, I'm guessing.
Yes, I would say so. I mean, I think that some of the early mentors, if you will, meaning his own contemporaries when he was a child and when he was a teenager, were these other black musicians who were playing music that he'd never heard before. And there's a story in the book about him going on these, his life obviously was very tied into the parish as a Catholic family, and the social events he was kind of allowed to go on unaccompanied by his parents were these river boats. And he went on one of these river boats with the youth group at one point, and he heard the music before he even saw anyone, and it just blew his mind. He knew it was something way different than he'd ever experienced before. And when he finally found his way to where all these musicians were set up, of course, it was an entirely black band, and he could not be dragged away for the 3 hours. His friends kept saying, come on, let's go play jacks. Let's go get into some trouble. And he just sat there and stared and studied and started talking to them and picked up, you know, some new musical vocabulary that day.
That's so wonderful. And I love the idea that in these books, that's what we find, these interesting side stories about how they were influenced in life and sort of something that we don't hear in a, you know, normal biography. We get this moment not even tangents, but more special stories like that. How cool. Who were the competitors that he had to work against, or did he work with them? How did that work out?
Well, what's interesting about the quote-unquote competitors were that, you know, you think of the other big film composers of his day, and, you know, names that come to mind would be like Miklos Rocha, or I don't speak Hungarian, so excuse me, but Dmitri Tiomkin, you know, Elmer Bernstein, Bernard Herrmann, and these guys were all very firmly planted in that big European symphonic sound, and they were amazing and brilliant, and they inspired Henry very much. But it was that point in time where things were changing, and he felt that change. And the way he interpreted that musically was to bring everything, make everything a little bit lighter. I mean, he loved this West Coast jazz movement that was going on, especially compared to what, you know, classic New York jazz, which is just heavier and, you know, a lot of gravitas. And this was more reflective of the California lifestyle. And so he was brilliant at really bringing those elements into his music and creating something that was airier and jazzier and sort of became this ultimate and cool sound. And the other thing I think that really drove that was early on with his budgets, he didn't have a tremendous amount of money to hire. So he would end up with, say, a six-piece or a 10-piece, you know, to record a score with. And it really became, you know, necessity as the mother of invention. And so he started to challenge himself about, well, how can I get the most sound out of this combination? And how can I, you know, use instruments that are rarely used? Like, he loved his first instrument was flute, so he always loved flutes. But he loved the bass flute, which was something that was even hard to find. There weren't even that many of them around. And many musicians refer to them as the plumber's nightmare because of this hairpin turn that it has. But Henry loved the sound of this thing. And so he would allow himself to be inspired by a really specific sound and then a really specific player. You know, for example, with the Pink Panther and the saxophonist Plas Johnson, who played the, you know, ba-dump, ba-dump, no one had that tone. That was Plas's tone. And so Henry really wrote around that to capitalize on that. And then the drummer Shelly Mann, you know, they had a great, who was huge part of that West Coast jazz scene, they had a great rapport, and when they would go in to record Henry's scores, they just had this great shorthand of, you know, Shelly, I need, you know, like a 1944 sound, and he'd say, 1944, you got it, what month?
That's hilarious. I love that. I love when you find a person who's clearly so born to do this one thing that they do and they excel at so much.
Yes. I mean, music was in his blood. His father was a flautist back in Italy, and I think it was when Henry was 7 and he was homesick from school. That just became the day that his father said, you know, you're bored, it's raining outside, go to the closet and get down these two cases. And he taught him how to put the flute together, and he gave him his first flute lesson. Well, you know, playing flute, if you've ever tried, takes some time because it's all about the embouchure to even get a sound to come out of it. And but from there, once it became really obvious that he was going to be a multi-instrumentalist because he just understood music as a language.
Well, that's a beautiful phrase. I like that idea. And it's true. That's what true musicians, it is that second language to them.
Right.
How pretty. So I take it that among the many important relationships in his life, his father was clearly one of them.
He was, for sure. His name was Quinto. He was named that because he was the fifth child in his family.
Okay.
Made sense. And he was kind of a hard scrabble guy who walked from his home in Abruzzo, I believe it was, to Naples to get on the ship to sail to New York. And I don't know how many miles that is, but it's a many days walk. And he never spoke much about that time. I mean, there was some hint that he was playing flute professionally for a little bit of his life while he was still in Italy, but he became a steel worker and he wanted to provide, you know, a good living for his family. Of course, they wanted to have more children and they were never able to. And so Henry became the one child that they poured all of their resources and love into.
Wow. And so what's the story of his mother?
His mother was very traditional Italian, you know, loved to cook, was much easier on Henry than the father was, of course. Tried to stick up for him sometimes when Henry would, you know, have disagreements with his father. For example, you know, Henry got so good on that flute that his father said, okay, great, well, it's time for you to join the, you know, Sons of Italy band with me. And he was like, I don't want to play in front of people. You know, he was a little kid, and that just did not appeal to him at all at that point. And he got a lot of pressure from his dad. And in fact, as he grew up and as he started winning Academy Awards and Emmys and every other thing, his father was never fully satisfied because he wanted his son to graduate from college, something that Quinto was never able to do, even go to a day of college. And Henry went to Juilliard for 1 year before getting called up for the war. But he wanted that so much for his son, and he wasn't able to make that switch in his mind that it's okay that my son didn't do that path. Look at all the other amazing things he's doing. He's conducting a hometown show at the Greek and then the Hollywood Bowl, but still that wasn't enough. He would literally make those comments walking out of the Hollywood Bowl about when are you going to get that, finish that degree.
Oh, that's so sad. That's so sad because I totally understand. I mean, it's interesting because you can understand the father's point of view, mm-hmm. and then you feel so upset that he could never make that adjustment. Who wouldn't want a kid with all that success? And yet, we define success differently in our world.
Right. And so his mother, you know, was much more supportive and never would have, you know, continued to give him that kind of a hard time about it. But she passed away fairly early on, and both of the parents had come out here to live in California with Henry and his family, and he put his dad on the payroll and bought him a car and bought him a house and did all these other great things for him, and yet he could still never get that full approval.
That's so sad. So before you started writing about him, what was your impression of him? What did you know about Henry Mancini before you started to research him?
Gosh, you know, well, Pink Panther for sure. Moon River, for sure, like most people, I would say. But I grew up in my grandparents' home, and just like Hank and Ginny ended up raising one of their grandchildren as one of their children. And my grandparents listened to a lot of Mancini. And so I remember those records. I remember loving it from a very young age. I feel, and I've read this, that other people have the same experience, you get this very distinct emotional hit from Mancini music. And one woman described it, I think it was Jean Lees, who was a pretty amazing music writer. It was his wife, I believe, who said, you know, listening to Mancini's music just makes you feel beautiful. And I just thought, you know, it's a little corny, but it's absolutely right.
I would agree. Beautiful in that way that you're surrounded by beauty. Maybe not like it turned you, but you're to be surrounded by that elegant sound.
Exactly.
Well, then in the course of researching, what was the most interesting thing you found along the way that you didn't know or that you were sure that you wanted to bring into the story?
I think one of the really surprising things for me in the research was because I had this impression that he was the king of cool and that music was so swanky and everything, was that he was incredibly shy. And this came through when he first met Ginny, who ended up being his wife, but she was a singer. And she and Hank met in what was Henry's really first job when he came back from the war. It was Glenn Miller's band, but Glenn Miller had perished in the war. So someone else, Tex, took over the Glenn Miller band, and Ginny joined it. Hank joined it, and she got a crush on him immediately. And he just really didn't have much experience, you know, with the ladies, and she really had to pursue him. So that was one element of how his shyness manifested. But then it also came back later in life when he had every reason to be super confident, and he had all these hits, and he'd made some incredible sort of precedent-setting business moves, such as convincing Blake Edwards that he should get to keep the copyrights to his music. No other TV composer had ever gotten that before, and then executives were not happy about it.
That's a brilliant business move. That's true.
It really was. It really was. So it was surprising then, at the point which Henry started, was asked by his agency, I believe, to start performing live, to do some public performances. And I think he was reluctant at first, but I think he was reluctant because he was busy and he didn't really see how that part was going to, you know, mesh with the rest of his, you know, all of his commitments. But he decided to do it, to give it a try. And I think he assumed that, well, I've done the hard part. I've written the music, I've arranged the music, I've got the band, I love my band members. But he didn't really appreciate what it was going to be like to be up there as the conductor and having to build some type of rapport with the audience. And so it was very difficult for him. And it took him a long time to cultivate a bit of a stage presence. And I think he was, you know, he was frustrated that it didn't come to him more naturally. But obviously he overcame that and became, you know, very beloved as someone, as a conductor, to go and watch and listen to the Henry Mancini Orchestra do, you know, more and more of his hits and other popular hits of the day. But it was something he struggled with, and it was interesting to watch that process unfold in the research, how he became comfortable with it eventually.
So interesting, another thing that someone who's very excelling in one area has to practice the skill that other people find second nature to them.
Exactly. And I think that is why he sort of took it for granted at the beginning, before he tried it, where you just get up there with a baton and I'm in charge and they all know what they're doing, even if I wasn't standing here. But that because it's a live performance, people want to know. Now they're getting a face to match the music that they love so much, and they crave a little bit more of the person and the persona or the personality. Little by little, he got more comfortable with this, especially when he started touring with Andy Williams, and the two of them were, you know, just great friends, and Andy had a humongous hit with Moon River, and so it became like just guys on the road, and they had a lot of fun.
That's so cool. Now, because you mentioned this, of course, I wanted to get around to this concept of, so he was in World War II.
Yes.
And what is this story, this sad story, I'm sure, about being involved in liberating a camp? That's just such a terrible thing to think about, and yet a beautiful thing to have contributed to.
Yes. I can't even imagine someone now at the age that Henry was then, 21, some right around there. And Greatest Generation, right? So when they got called up, nobody complained. They went and did their thing. He felt lucky that he got to do something musical while he was in the war. So he didn't love the actual post, which was going out into the field with a pump organ to do services out in the field. So this chaplain was really in charge of him. And the chaplain was kind of on the take and buying up all this champagne in France, you know, for cheap.
Oh my gosh.
And then reselling it to the troops at this amazing markup. And so Henry was so mad, and he couldn't stand this guy, and he often wrote letters home complaining about this man. So that was the bulk of his time, and that right before the liberation. So there was Mauthausen, and there was a sister camp, which I am blanking on the name right now. But Mauthausen in Austria was the camp that was designed to imprison the intelligentsia. And they really, really wanted to make the smart people, the cultured people, suffer the most, the people who are questioning them. And I mean, they even they built something called, I think, the Stairway of Death or something, where they would have people bringing up massive boulders just with their own hands up these stairs, and inevitably one drops it, one falls. It's a domino effect, and that's how people were dying. And so by the time that Henry's unit was approaching, the SS had fled. So it was just the prisoners there. I mean, basically everybody was in black and white stripes. So it was just a scene to come upon where you saw the suffering. And I mean, I think the most visceral detail that he remembered is the ovens were warm. You touched the side of the... And so it was an experience, as I think most people can relate to, if they had a father, a grandfather, someone who served in that war, that this Greatest Generation didn't talk a whole lot about this. So we don't have a ton of straight from the horse's mouth, if you will, how did you feel about this, Henry? We just know that he was happy to be there. When he was there, he was happy to be celebrating their freedom with them and know that this was going to be the end to this evil.
That's such a beautiful story. It just makes you stop and think. And you wonder if there was some, clearly an experience like that helps add some of the depth to the kind of work that he did and what he was thinking about as he created all this, again, bringing beauty back into the world after having seen such devastation.
I think so. I mean, I think it does go back to, you know, that idea for Hank of equality. You know, even when we were having much worse race relation problems in our country, I think most musicians would agree that amongst equals, really great musicians, race has never mattered. And so they really lead the way and they model the right humanity. and so I think that those experiences did make him appreciate, because he never changed. He was the same guy all throughout his, unfortunately, too short of a life. But he always appreciated what he had. And I think, you know, growing up poor in the steel town and then experiences like that, like the war, juxtaposed with your great home in Beverly Hills and your beautiful wife and family and, you know, on the top of the world as far as Hollywood goes, it's a good balance to have in your life despite the tragedy that he had to witness.
I think that's true. And I think that helps keep an artist, as you say, balanced, in that they don't take too much for granted because they understand sort of the depths of both sides.
Exactly.
How interesting. Wow. All right, so all that is true, which is fascinating. Was there any scene that you had to invent along the way because it was something that you wanted to use as a connection between moments in his life? Or, you know, what was the scene that you enjoyed writing the most?
Well, I wouldn't say it invented. I had the great privilege of working with one of Henry's daughters as a kind of a consultant on the book, Monica Mancini. So Henry and Ginny had three children. Chris Jr. was their firstborn, their only son, and then twin girls. So Monica grew up to be a singer, and, you know, Grammy-nominated singer. She performs his songbook even today. So I felt like I had a lot of the real stuff, the real story. There's no lack of source material when it comes to Mancini and his life. So one of my favorite stories, though, because it illustrates all these other things we've been talking about, is that his best childhood friend, John, back in West Aliquippa, he grew up to be a band director and, you know, songwriter as well, like wrote some college, you know, pep songs with his wife, and really great guy. He was having a fundraiser for his high school band. Now, they'd won a lot of national honors, so they weren't slacking off. This is a very impressive high school band. But, you know, Henry was at the apex of his career when John said, well, the worst he could say is no, right? So I'm going to call him up and see, you know, if we can get him, convince him to come out here and participate in this. It's a fundraiser. And so, I mean, no hesitation whatsoever, despite the fact it was going to be Henry's birthday. So he flies out there. They do the whole night, play Moon River, play all the big hits. And then Henry surprised John even more when he came through the back of the house, through the auditorium, playing his flute and then joining the high schoolers on stage for the finale. So it was just, I think, illustrates his selflessness.
Well, that's a beautiful story. I agree all around. So that makes me think about the idea that we were always interested in the Mentors Project. Who were his mentors, and who did he mentor as a grown-up?
Well, his mentor, I would say, who's responsible for, you know, sort of the whole trajectory of his career, was a man named Max Adkins. And he was in Pittsburgh. So once Henry's father realized this kid needs a lot more teaching than I can give him, and he needs a good piano teacher. Henry had been studying with a piano teacher in Pittsburgh, so making this trek from West Aliquippa to Pittsburgh, I think twice a week for his piano lessons. And so Quinto asked the piano teacher, do you know someone who can teach my son arranging? Because there really was no definitive text on the subject. In fact, Henry wrote that text much later in life because there still wasn't one. But he had the good fortune of meeting Max Adkins, who was right across the street from the piano teacher in Pittsburgh. And he was the pit band conductor at the Stanley Theater. So this was the theater that all the big bands would play when they'd come through town. And Henry was already a crazy Benny Goodman fan. And he didn't know that you could buy music paper that was already lined. So he was making his own. And when he showed that to Max Adkins, it was just, I think, the sweetest thing the guy had ever seen. And I can get you some of that paper. I can save you some time. So he thought, this kid is more motivated than anybody I've seen. He's clearly incredibly talented. And so you had, on the one hand, somebody who could teach him all the arranging that he so wanted. And this was the big band era, so it was like lots of instruments and lots of different ways to arrange things. And then on the other hand, being the conductor at this place, the big bands were coming through. And Benny Goodman was coming through. And it sounded like usually it was a residency, so they'd play for a week or 2 weeks at a time. And Henry really kind of freaked out when Max said, I want you to meet Mr. Goodman. And walked down to his, you know, dressing room and knocked on the door. Henry could barely get any words out, but was thrilled to meet him. And little did he know that that was really Max planting the seed with Benny Goodman, so that at some point when Henry was ready, he could pitch him as an arranger. That was amazing, and it put him on this track. Max was the guy who said, you know, you really should go to Juilliard. And Henry said, well, I don't think my family could ever afford Juilliard. He said, no, you're going to get a scholarship. We'll make sure you get a scholarship. And he did. And then the other part of it was, I can be your music mentor, but I also clearly want to teach you some things about life before you go off to the big city. So they would go out for meals, and Max taught him about tipping and taught him about shoe shines and took him to get fitted for his first like custom real suit. He said, if you're going to be a professional musician, you're going to need a good suit. So he mentored him in all those respects.
Oh, that's so beautiful. We were at the Frank Lloyd Wright home a while back, and he trained his architects how to eat with rich clients and, you know, which forks to use, the classic joke, but literally what would you do when faced with that? Because he didn't care what background they'd come from, but he knew they would mix in very rich worlds and they had to be prepared. So that makes perfect sense that you wouldn't want him to not be ready for that as well.
Exactly. Oh. And I think he realized that Henry's parents were amazing and very devoted to him, but they were not sophisticated people. And that if Henry was going to go off to New York and really exist and thrive in this world, there were some things he needed to know about.
That's beautiful. All right. So that's a wonderful name to know, Max Adkins. Mm-hmm. But now we need to know, who did Henry Mancini mentor as he grew older?
So many people. really and truly, because he loved doing it. But I would say the most successful and the most famous person is Quincy Jones. He met Quincy, I think, originally in Europe. But Quincy, much like Hank, was so multi-talented in music as far as a musician and a writer and an arranger and a composer and a producer and everything. And again, this was a time when people in the hiring positions were not entirely comfortable handing out these big assignments to people that they questioned, for whatever reason, could do the job. And so Henry was very, very supportive of Quincy, as I said earlier, with that one instance, because I think those undertones kind of came through to him, and he wanted to send the message that you're the person that needs to get with the program. You are really, really wrong on this, and you're missing out if you don't hire him. And then as time went on and Quincy started doing some television, well, that's a whole nother beast. I mean, for writers, for composers, because the pace is so much more intense, and the amount of music that he had to produce for episodic work. And it was really funny because Alfred Newman was the person that Quincy most wanted to meet when he moved to Los Angeles. And Hank facilitated that because he and Ginny held a baby shower at their home for Quincy and his wife and invited Alfred. And the minute Alfred met Quincy, he loved him. So he was automatically invited to the 5 o'clock cocktail hour daily, pretty much, at Alfred's place on Sunset. But Alfred and Henry both would, you know, Quincy asked him, can you look over my Ironside scores? Because he was new to TV and he just wanted to make sure, am I hitting all the right notes? Yeah, you're hitting all the right notes. In fact, you're hitting way too many notes. They saw all the 16th notes on the page and said, you can't write Stravinsky's Rite of Spring every week if you want to survive the season. So it was really cute, and it was just because Quincy was working so hard, you know, and that was just his work ethic and his way, that it was a little bit of his naivete to prevent him from realizing that you can lay out a little bit, you can make things a bit easier for yourself. And so they gave him the confidence to do that. And in fact, there's a new Netflix documentary on Quincy Jones just called Quincy. And I think it's within the first 5 minutes of the film he mentions Mancini. So
that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, that's real. Well, now I have to go watch that, of course. Oh, that's wonderful. I always like to wrap these things out by asking you who your mentors are.
Well, my mentor was Karen Walter Goodwin, who is my late aunt, my dad's sister. And kind of the interesting thing about her, I mean, she's like Hank. She was a force. And she just changed the energy when she walked into a room. And she was very, I mean, the smartest person I ever knew, the most cultured. She just impressed me in every way from a very young age. But the ironic part about our connection and our relationship was that my parents split up when I was a baby because they were very young parents. And so I lived on the West Coast with my mom and her family, and my aunt was on the East Coast. But she wrote me letters like a pen pal, and she sent me books to read, all kinds of books and philosophy when I was in middle school. And because in her mind, even if I didn't understand or couldn't appreciate everything, exposure was really important to her. And she didn't know much about the schools I was going to and all the trouble I was getting into, but she had the ideas of what she wanted to make sure I was exposed to. And then when I got to college age, she'd become a Broadway producer. She was always kind of in the art world, but she became a Broadway producer and co-financed Cameron Mackintosh's London version of Les Mis. So this is even before New York. And that performance, that run was panned by critics.
I had no idea.
So they didn't think that was ever going to get to New York. So okay. That was her first time out with Cameron, and then they went on to do Phantom of the Opera together and Miss Saigon together. So she became kind of a giant in the Broadway musical world, and she invited me. I had been going to school in San Diego, but full-time student, two part-time jobs, kind of burning at both ends. And she said, she brought me up on the train to go to the LA premiere of Phantom, and made me the proposition, why don't you come back, you know, to the East and live with me? I'll pay for your college tuition. You can help out with the baby on weekends. Sounds good to me. And so she lived in D.C. at the time because her husband was a professor. And I ended up going to the American University there and got to go to New York with her a whole bunch, which allowed me to develop my love affair with New York. And sadly, you know, we lost her just a few years ago to cancer. And like Hank, I think it's true that some of the brightest stars burn out early.
Oh, that's so beautiful and so sad. I'm sorry about that. What a beautiful woman. And so wonderful to have a chance to talk about her achievements, because often women who finance and support and have done this kind of work, we lose them in history to the names of the men who did the other part of the work. And I love bringing those names back out.
Boy, so do I.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, this has been a marvelous. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. And I look forward to people having a chance to read the book and learn more about Henry Mancini.
Great.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.